Thursday on Wings, we hear from our sister program in Australia, Women on the Line.
We all know that terrorism is a bad thing, but how we fight it is as important as the end result.
And the message that is being sent out is very clear, that all human rights are negotiable when it comes to security. What do you think that does for women's human rights?
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Where, after all, do universal human rights begin? In small places close to home, so close and so small that they cannot be seen on any maps of the world. Yet they are the world of the individual person. Unless these rights have meaning there, they have little meaning anywhere. Without concerted citizen action to uphold them close to home, we shall look in vain for progress in the larger world. Those are the words of Eleanor Roosevelt, the most influential member of the United Nations Commission on Human Rights, which was responsible for drafting the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in the late 1940s. Hello and welcome to Women on the Line. I'm Rowan McRae and I'll be with you on the program this week. In many countries, human rights defenders who continue to work towards a world where basic human rights are respected, protected and fulfilled are subjected to discrimination, abuse and violence in the course of their activism. Many people have paid with their lives for daring to defend their own human rights and the rights of others. Women fighting for human rights, in particular, face specific violations in the course of their work because of their gender. In late November, the International Coordinating Committee of the International Campaign on Women Human Rights Defenders held a consultation in Sri Lanka, bringing together women human rights defenders from around 200 countries to celebrate the work of defenders of women's rights and women defending human rights. Today on Women on the Line, we're going to hear from two prominent human rights defenders who spoke at that consultation. Radhika Kumaraswamy is the chairperson of the Human Rights Commission in Sri Lanka. Previously, she served as the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women. In that role, she reported on the problems of comfort women in Japan and Korea, domestic violence in Brazil, trafficking of women in Poland, rape in South Africa, and women in prisons in the USA. She also visited Rwanda and East Timor to investigate violence against women during armed conflict. In Afghanistan, she considered issues of religious extremism, and in India, Nepal, and Bangladesh, she reported on the trafficking of young girls. At the consultation, Radhika Kumaraswamy identified the key challenges faced by women human rights defenders today.
I think the greatest challenge we face, the human rights tradition today, is the war on terror. I think just calling it a war and the kind of activities that have been taken in its name has really put human rights back a great deal. We all know that terrorism is a bad thing, but how we fight it is as important as the end result. We are creating situations where countless young men join the forces of violence because they feel humiliated and degraded by the type of action taken in the name of the war on terror. Women themselves are subject, as we know, in places such as Abu Ghraib, to torture. I think it is very important that since political and civil rights, to which all of us believe, is the first tradition of human rights, supposedly, in chronological order, it was something we all took for granted as the bulwark of the human rights tradition. And now we find that it is under threat, that a lot of the rights that we felt guaranteed, the systems we put in place, the structures that were there, are now being questioned. I think it is very important that we come out of the women framework for a while and join forces with all human rights groups around the world to say, we will not let you institutionalize or normalize these trends, these practices that have emerged in the last few years, and that we will continue to support the United Nations standards, United Nations systems and practices of human rights, and that we will make sure that they are there for the next generation as there were for the generation before us. The second challenge we face, I feel, as human rights activists and women's rights defenders, is cultural, so-called cultural relativism. Partha Chatterjee, the Indian scholar, when analyzing the nationalist movement of India, argues that there was what he calls a nationalist resolution of the women's question, which was that while men would go out into the public world and assert and become part of globalized processes and institutional systems, women would stay at home and be the cultural custodians. So the link between culture, women, and spirituality, he said, was developed by these nationalist and religious movements that came up in the rise against colonialism. So this link between women, culture, and spirituality that has been created by the male leaders of our nationalist movements, as well as the others that have fought for it, is a very hard equation to crack, and it is resistant to political rationalism. But I think we as women have to come up with effective international and national strategies to deal with this very complicated issue. I think we have come to the stage where those kinds of cultural practices that resemble what in law are called jus cogens, human rights violations, those human rights violations that are so universally condemned that they are cannot be derogated, the fight against them cannot be derogated. Those include torture, extrajudicial killings, disappearances. So those violations against women that resemble those, such as sati, honor killings, FGM, cannot be tolerated, and we cannot in any way put up with them. With regard to the other host of economic and social violations, such as unequal inheritance, dress codes, a whole host of issues relating to the distribution of property, all those kinds of issues that come up in the Sharia and personal laws of the world, including my own in Sri Lanka, the Tamil personal law, we have to devise an effective strategy, whether we are going to fight constantly for secularism and to insist on one law for all women, or whether we are going to evolve a strategy of searching for maybe a minimum core that we will protect. But in fighting against these laws, and I think we must unite in a strategy to fight against them, I think we must also be careful not to be complicit with the arrogant gaze of imperialism, because often that is the excuse used in fighting our struggle by the male leaders of our society. Thirdly, the challenge we face, I think, is one of globalization. Globalization is not new. There's increasing disparity between the rich and the poor. But I think what we have to do, and I think we have to refocus international struggle on economic, social, and cultural rights. We all know that the welfare states that have grown up around us can be bureaucratic nightmares, but let us be imaginative and work toward how to protect economic, social, and cultural rights, the right to education, the right to housing, the right to food, the right to health, in the context of globalization. And how most important to fight inequality. Poverty figures in Sri Lanka show that while in the cities, poverty has halved over the last 10 years, in certain rural areas, poverty has actually increased in the era of globalization. Finally, let me just say that as women's rights activists, as we face these challenges, let us be grateful for what has happened in the last 20 years. I think we have come a long way. When I became special rapporteur on violence against women in 1993, in the area of armed conflict, we didn't even have international law. The Japanese government could argue to me that there is no international customary law that prevents women from being raped during wartime. Now that has changed. At least the ICC and the international courts in Arusha and The Hague, we don't have to fight for the standards anymore. Same thing with domestic violence and a whole host of crimes that were invisible against women. We have now named them. The time has come now to shame them. the issue that we found as we looked at the countries when I gave up in 2003, we did a country-by-country survey on what has been done on violence against women. We found every country in the world has done something in the last 10 years on the issue of violence against women, whether it's passing legislation, whether it's passing national plans of action, whether it's having training programs sensitizing their judiciaries and police, whether it's providing support services for women victims. Every country had done something. However, the figures on the ground had not changed. So the issue for the next decade is one of implementation, of actually taking the standards we took so much trouble to build and making them real in the actual lives of women. But in doing so, my concern, increasing concern, as I gave up my post as UN Special Rapporteur, and especially in the area coming out of trafficking, is what I would call the rise of law and order feminism. I think this is a great issue. This is an important issue that faces human rights defenders, especially women's rights activists. We have seen in many areas, especially in the area of trafficking, the rise of a feminism that focuses on only punishment and prosecution of perpetrators, that focuses on the repressive reliant and being very much in partnership with the repressive arm of the state, that pushes for draconian legislation such as death penalty and everything that we have fought against in other human rights traditions. And I think we have to take stock and say, what is important to us are the women victims and survivors of these violences. And it's their rights and their voices that have to be heard and listened to in formulating our strategies, not the voice of law enforcement or law and order. And finally, we have to break the silence on sexuality internationally. I think that's extremely important. As I did my work on violence against women, I realized that practically every form of violence against women relates to male control of female sexuality, has some basis in that, and communities' control of female sexuality. That the acceptance of female autonomy is as important as economic independence in preventing violence and in securing women's rights. And my final word, I keep saying finally and I keep going on, but this is my very final word, which is that we ourselves are now under scrutiny. I don't know if you're aware, in academic circles, articles are being written about human rights defenders in a critical way. People are saying that we are becoming human rights entrepreneurs, that we are caught in a donor trap, that we are only promoting our own, we have lost touch with the people. All this is being written. In all criticism, some is exaggerated, some is valid. And I think when we move on, we should listen to those voices and meet the challenges put forward by those criticisms and realize that human rights is not an end only in itself. It is also a means by which we can strive to attain a more peaceful and just world. She's got
a story too. That was Radhika Kumaraswamy, chairperson of the Human Rights Commission in Sri Lanka, speaking about the challenges faced by women human rights defenders. Next, we're going to hear from Irene Khan, the first woman, the first Asian, and the first Muslim to take the position of Secretary General of Amnesty International. As Secretary General, Irene Khan has called for better protection of women's human rights in meetings with President Musharraf of Pakistan, President Lahoud of Lebanon, and Prime Minister Khaled Azia of Bangladesh. She has also initiated a process of consultations with women activists to design a global campaign to combat violence against women.
Hello everyone. I must first apologize for not having been here at this conference earlier. The reason why I couldn't be here is that I had another meeting in China. And last night I arrived from China, where Mao Feng is one of many thousands of women defenders who dared to protest China's one-child policy and petition the authorities on women's human rights. And for that, for the past 17 years, Mao Feng has been persecuted. She's been thrown in prison. She was forced to undergo an abortion. She was fired from her job. She was subjected to re-education labor, detained in a psychiatric hospital, and forcibly medicated. She has just been released. She was one of the cases that Amnesty had supported. She's just been released, but she is still threatened. And as I said, she's just one of many thousands. The week before I left for China, I was in London, where Amnesty's headquarters is based, and there I met another woman human rights defender, a very different type of woman a human rights defender. She is an African Muslim woman called Jacqueline, whose husband is a refugee from Algeria. He suffers from polio and is wheelchair bound, but he was arrested by the British authorities in December 2001, imprisoned without charge or trial for 3 years as a terrorist suspect, released earlier this year, tagged, which meant, you know, he had a little thing around his leg so that the police could monitor where he went, rearrested in August, threatened with deportation, and is now under house arrest, waiting to be returned to Algeria, although he was previously tortured there. Jacqueline, on Eid Day in early November, took the initiative to develop a petition. She brought together other family members of detainees in similar situation, and she wrote a petition which she sent to Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister, in which she challenged his approach to detention, and she put to him the whole issue of collective punishment, that families are being made to suffer for something that they obviously have not done. Now, Jacqueline, what struck me about Jacqueline, she's a housewife, she wears a hijab, she hardly ever went out of the house until her husband was imprisoned. And by force of circumstance, she is now a women human rights defender. She has thrown a new light on the hidden cost that women are paying for the so-called war on terror. So I think with these two cases of Mao Feng and Jacqueline, one sees the range of situations that women human rights defenders have to cope with. In 1993 in Vienna, women captured the human rights movement with the rallying call that women's rights are human rights. In 1995, women translated that call into a concrete plan of action in Beijing. And earlier this year, women resisted the effort to backtrack on that plan of action. Each of those events are landmarks on the global scene. But we know that the real struggle for women's human rights are not fought on the international scene. They are actually fought in small places, in little villages, in suburbs where people like Mao Feng and Jacqueline live. And this conference is actually about them, the unspoken, unsung heroines, about their contribution, their courage, their resilience. As women human rights defenders, we do not just challenge the abuse of human rights. We challenge the abuse of patriarchal power, privilege, and leadership, and prejudice. We question social and religious conventions. We seek to force people out of their comfort zones. And when you expose violence in the home, you're accused of betraying your family. When you demand that women are entitled to autonomy over their lives and their bodies, you are labeled as promiscuous and loose. When you demand equal access to education and employment, or equal rights to land and property, you are portrayed as trying to break up families and communities. So unlike our male human rights activists, we women are not just exposed to hostility. We are attacked personally. Our lifestyles, our values, our identity and our integrity is attacked. And I know that many of you have spoken passionately and vividly about that reality, which impacts on the credibility and legitimacy of women human rights defenders, which isolates us and makes us more vulnerable to violence. Particularly, I think, those among us who are working on issues of sexuality and reproductive rights. Now, in my view, there are three key factors which have combined together to increase the risks and threats faced by human rights defenders. I don't see them as three separate issues. I actually see them as three issues, each reinforcing the other in a downward spiral. First, I think, is the fact that human rights defenders still lack real legitimacy in many parts of the world. And just coming from China, of course, I feel acutely aware of it. I went to China to attend a conference organized by the United Nations on business and human rights. But it was only under severe pressure from the UN that the Chinese authorities gave me a visa for 4 days just to be able to attend the conference and leave the country, nothing more. And no Chinese participant, official or unofficial, in the conference used the term human rights. They would talk about harmonious relations in the community. I met a young woman professor in Shanghai who is just beginning a course teaching the rights of gay and lesbian people. And she's a very brave woman to do that. As she and I were speaking in the room, a gentleman walked in, didn't introduce himself to us, but sat pretty close to us with his back to us, obviously listening to our conversation. I felt uneasy, but I must say, to her credit, the professor continued saying exactly what she was saying. I just hope that she is safe. I've seen that same suspicion towards human rights activists in countries as far apart as Russia and Rwanda, Bangladesh and Colombia. So I think the lack of legitimacy of human rights work makes it very difficult for women's human rights defenders to work. The second factor is one that Radhika has raised, and that is the war on terror. But together with the war on terror, increased militarization, and on the back of it, the rise of right-wing and religious fundamentalism. Earlier this year, Amnesty International produced a report on the link between proliferation of small arms and violence against women. Now, that report looked at only one small part of a much bigger picture in which women's concerns are being pushed back, manipulated, and openly undermined by national security agenda. For instance, as military budgets increase, spending on education and health falls. And who do you think is affected by that? And the message that is being sent out is very clear, that all human rights are negotiable when it comes to security. What do you think that does for women's human rights? And we see this sort of hype on security, and this growth of fundamentalism is squeezing the space for liberal thinking and for diversity. This is very, very dangerous, even in many democratic societies. The third factor that I want to emphasize is impunity and lack of accountability. Now, impunity and lack of accountability are major causes behind all violence against women. When women human rights defenders are attacked, often the state turns a blind eye. Sometimes it actively aids and abets it. And more often, it fails to provide any protection. And because of the entrenched, pervasive nature of gender discrimination, what we see is compound impunity. The general impunity towards abuse of human rights defenders, but with it, another layer of abuse, impunity for abuse of women, and yet another layer of impunity for abuse of women who are working on issues like sexual and reproductive rights. And over and above it all, in the case, for example, of minority women, indigenous women, we also see other issues coming in. And too many governments are still too unwilling to tackle non-state actors. Now, whether the perpetrator is a policeman or a community leader, whether the attacks are officially sanctioned or implicitly spurred on by the media, the state cannot shirk its responsibility. That is pretty clear. The principle of due diligence is well established, and yet every day the government turns a blind eye to that. But if there are negative trends on one side, there are also positive ones on the other. And for me, the most positive, the most energizing factor is the way in which women themselves have come together in solidarity at the local, national, regional, and global levels. We know that the gains that have been made in women's human rights have come about because of the work that women themselves have done. And Sometimes it begins with local initiatives. Think back to the 1970s and 80s. Think of the mothers, the movement of the mothers in Argentina, who stood up, who used their image, their identity as women, as mothers, to begin the resistance movement against military dictatorships and to expose human rights abuses such as disappearances. In August this year, I was in Mexico to meet with the mothers of Ciudad Juarez. With that same tradition, these are women who are exposing the way in which women workers in assembly plants in Ciudad Juarez, in the north of Mexico, are being murdered, attacked, are disappearing, and the local authorities are doing nothing because these are poor women working in assembly plants, coming from the poorest parts of Mexico. They fuel the global economy but receive no protection from it. And these women, the mothers of Ciudad Juarez, have actually put their issue on the agenda and working together with other organizations, with the Inter-American Commission, with Amnesty International, and with others, they have actually forced the government of Mexico to take action. The women's movement put forward that big slogan, as you know, personal is political. And I think for Amnesty, it is that the local must be global. What you are doing at the local level, we have to bring it up, strengthen it up there, and make it a struggle of equality and justice for all.
I long to spend time with my sisters. A great story.
That was Irene Khan, Secretary General of Amnesty International, speaking at the International Consultation on Women Human Rights Defenders in Sri Lanka. And that's all for Women on the Line today. Women on the Line is Community Radio's national women's current affairs program. It's produced and presented by a range of women broadcasters from 3CR in Melbourne and distributed nationally via the Community Radio Network service of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia. If you'd like to contact the producers of Women on the Line, you can phone 3CR on 03 9419 8377 or email us at women_onTheLine@yahoo.com.au. The theme music for Women on the Line is Kerri-Ann Cox's She's Got a Story Too. I'm Rowan McRae. Hope you can tune in again next week.
Special moments with my mother. We talk about the things that haunt within us. I sit there and listen to the stories she tells. Well, listen, I know when I'm made. Stories listen to. And she's got a story. Make you sad, so make you cry, some make you mad. When it's just upon a bed, yeah.
You can hear this program and others again in the web archive at www.wings.org. Thanks to our supporters, including Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of Il Dono, The Gift. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.